Well, good evening, everyone. This is SCARS, the South Coast Amateur Radio Service. This net is conducted under the guidelines of the SCARS organization and further follows the rules outlined in FCC Part 97 and Good Amateur Practice. This SCARS server is supplied by the Great Lakes Reflector System, provided by Kilo Bravo 8 Zulu Golf Lima. And all contacts and requests for information will be handled through the net control. When contact with another station is made, please move off the system and establish your contact direct so the net may continue. In fairness to all, short-time stations will not be recognized as such. All stations will be worked in the order in which they've checked in. Information regarding our operation may be found on our website, and that's SCARS, SCARSVOIP.com. Your net control actually this evening is KY6D and W4RFJ and friends. My name is Kathy. My call sign is Kilo 6 Sierra United November, and I'm merely opening it up this evening. I'm located in the rainy city of Port St. Lucie, Florida, South Florida, with a temperature of 75 degrees was our high, and 66 will be our low tonight. But it is currently raining. So prior to starting, I'd like to ask if there's any emergency traffic or anything out of the ordinary that needs to be handled at this time. If so, I ask you to come aboard. All right, hearing no emergency traffic, how about anyone celebrating a birthday, either last week, maybe today, or maybe this upcoming week, that would like to come aboard so we could say happy, happy birthday? No birthdays either. I always say this. That just means we're not getting any older. All right. Good evening once again. This is the TIN Open Forum, monthly Thursday informational net forum, or we call it TIN for short. This net is conducted to provide information pursuant to amateur-related subjects and or other areas of general interest to those participating. All are encouraged to participate and ask questions of our guest speaker or speakers. And I do want to advise you that it is being recorded for future presentation on our website as a podcast. So if you've been part of this session tonight, you most definitely will be part of that recording. Our topic this evening is part two about this and that about antennas. So we ask that if you have any questions of our guest speakers, that you surely throw them out to them this evening. And as far as I understand, Gordon, KY6V, you'll begin this evening. And so I'm going to throw it over to you. I'll be listening in the background, making those little snowmen. But I have a recording on, and I'll be listening. So KY6V, are you ready to take over?
I am. Thank you very much, pretty lady. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Gordon KY6V here. I don't see my partner in crime and co-producer connected as yet. He may be running late from work. If that's the case, George, I would ask, thank you for setting your recording on also, to maybe grab a copy of the goings on tonight in case we need a little bit of backup. Well, this is part two for TIN. We're discussing antennas. Part one was last month. I don't know where the time went because it seemed like it was just yesterday that we did part one. And where we left off last month was just prior to getting into talking about SWR, standing wave ratio, and how it affects things. So we're going to pick it up from that point and move forward and see how things work out. Let me buy a nickel and rejuvenate all the timers before I start. Okay, how to read your SWR correctly. Again, SWR, standing wave ratio. Ideal conditions are when conditions exist that allow maximum power transfer to the antenna and maximum radiation is obtained. This is realized when everything is properly matched. and that is to say that all input and output impedances are proper, and we have what is referred to as a one-to-one transfer. When this condition exists, any length of coax may be used, and forward and reverse power may be read accurately at any point along the transmission system. Determining this condition accurately is a horse of another color. Let me buy the timer. Okay, we just got a text message that Roger is on the scene and will be right with us. So going on the discussion here, SWR, when the impedance of the transmission line is different than the impedance of the input of the antenna, a mismatch occurs. Depending on the severity of this mismatch, part or all of the forward power from the transmitter is reflected to the transmitter from the antenna. This results in a standing wave on the transmission line and is related to the ratio of the forward power to that of the reflected power. Now, obviously, this all relates to reduced effectivity, loss of antenna radiation, and in blunt words, a weaker transmitted signal. By the by, I might say that impedance is defined as the symbol Z, a measure of the total opposition to current flow. Remember that one. It's opposing the current flow in an alternating current system. And it's made up of two components, ohmic resistance and reactance. And it's usually represented in a complex notation as Z equals R plus JX. R is the ohmic resistance, X is the reactance, and the J is an operative showing either a plus sign or a minus sign, plus indicating inductive reactance and minus indicating capacitive reactance. Let me buy another nickel. And I see the chief is with us. Hi, chief. So from a practical standpoint, how do we know what we have a mismatch or not? And better yet, determine that everything is operating properly. We start by using what is called an SWR bridge. And this is a unit that is inserted in series with a transmission line and tells us the amount of forward power and any reflected power that may exist. It is important to understand how this device works. This SWR meter is normally a voltage sensing device. It utilizes a pair of diodes, one reading the forward direction, excuse me, and the other the reverse direction. It reads the voltage that is sampled at the point that it has been inserted in the transmission line. Let me buy another nickel. Now, there are only two positions of the SWR meter that will read you your antenna system correctly. Now, I want you to listen to this one. This is to say, to determine the exact state of your system. The first is to insert the meter at the antenna input terminals or at the end of a predetermined length of coax. Now, placing the meter at the antenna is not always a practical answer, particularly if the antenna is on a 20-foot mast, which is situated on the top of a 200-foot tower. You'll have to laugh about that one. Here's where the velocity factor comes in. It is a proven fact that if your coax length is equal to an even multiple of a half-wave frequency that you are testing, that the SW read at the far end of the coax from the antenna will be identical to the SWR read at the antenna. Now, to arrive at half-wave length, the following should be done. Use the formula 492 divided by the frequency in megacycles. That's step one. take that answer, which is in feet, and multiply it by the velocity factor of the coax that you're using. Now, that could be 0.66 for poly, it could be 0.80 for foam, and on you go. And then you have a perfect half wave or multiple thereof. Let me buy another nickel. So, okay, I'm sometimes asked the question, what type of SWR meter should I be using and how to calibrate it accurately? And the answer that I normally give is, other than that which has already just been mentioned, a VSWR meter that gives you the ability or availability to set your calibration is recommended. Now, this is normally an easy and quick setup. One places the meter in the forward position, keys the transmitter, sets the calibration control so that the forward power lines up with the set position shown on the meter. And this is normally the upper quadrant of your meter itself. And with this step done, your meter will read accurately the ratio between your forward and reflected power. So, at this point, I'd like to open it up, say good evening, everybody. Do you have any questions on what was just said? Do you have any questions that you would pose that you would like us to discuss tonight? We're going to get in at one point asking you what your favorite antenna is and why, and that kind of thing. Anybody would like to check in or anything going on right now? KY6V, please.
H.A.
November X-ray, India.
Well, I'll get in on this one. Romeo Fox Juliet.
Hey, thank you, Chief. Thank you, Mike up there in Maine, and hello, Fred. I'll take three at a time here. H.A., Mr. Pennsylvania, come aboard. Well, I saw your key up earlier. I didn't hear your audio, only because my speaker was turned down a little low. But I thought I was seeing your dash L, but I do see your, apparently your cell phone's connected also. One more try, Hotel Alpha, please. All right, we'll have to come back to them. NXI, hi, Mike. I bet you it's cold up in your neck of the woods. Go ahead, sir.
Good evening, Gordon, and everybody aboard. This is WA1 NXI up here in the great state of Maine. It is a little chilly, Gordon. I think it's still above freezing. It was last time I was out. We're also getting rain. I believe Kathy said you guys were getting some rain today. And same here. It rained all day. Good net so far. I'm listening in, and I already talked about what my favorite antenna was, that beam I used to have, but tomorrow I will be in the process of, I'm going to probably a 20 meter dipole first. I'm going to build that. And I did have one question. You might have kind of already answered it. When I build that and I'm going to cut it for the center of the band, and then when my SWR, when I check that, if it's not right, how do I know if I have to add or if I have to take off a little bit of wire? I've been doing a little bit of looking online, and I downloaded this sheet that said know your math, but I haven't really studied it yet. But anyway, that's what I'll be doing tomorrow, trying to get back on 20 meters, and after I get that all tuned in, we'll go from there. But 20 being my favorite is where I'm going to start. Anyway, listening in and enjoying the net. WA1NXI, back to KY6V and TNT net.
Did I hear you say TNT like explosive? T-I-N. All right, Mike. Hey, a grand question, and I'm going to try and answer it. It'll take a minute or two here, so Roger, sit back and relax, Tiger, and I'll get right to you. The adding or subtracting Let me tell you my favorite technique. I do as you are doing. You're going to cut your antenna originally for the middle of the band. In this case, it's going to be 20 meters, you're saying. So you get it all hung up and plugged in, and you turn on your transmitter, and you look at your SWR meter, and it's going to give you a reading. If you did a good job and there wasn't too much in the way of the antenna field, you're probably going to be pretty close and have a decent SWR. I hope that you're using the formula 468 divided by the frequency in megacycles and not 492 that I use for coax, because 468 will take in consideration ground effects. Let me buy a nickel here. Okay, so after you've done all this, let's just say hypothetically you take your first reading and it's 1.5 to 1, okay? What I do is then I move the VFO on the transceiver down to the bottom of the band, and I take a SWR reading there. If it is lower, than your original reading, that immediately tells you that the antenna is long. I then turn around and I take it up to the top of the band and take a reading there. If it's higher than it was in the middle and lower on the bottom, it tells you that your antenna is long for getting to the frequency that you want. So now you can move your VFO around a little bit until you find the lowest SWR, hopefully very, very close to 1 to 1, and see what that frequency is. Now you take that frequency and figure out its wavelength in feet opposed to the original that you wanted, that you cut. You know what that footage was. And in the case of it being on the low side, you want to shorten your antenna, so you want to shorten it by the difference of those two figures, the original that you had and where the one-to-one is. Let's say it comes up to 6 inches, okay? And if that's the case, you know, you want to cut off 3 inches on both sides of the dipole. Does that make sense, Mike? Over.
Yep. Gordon, mostly. I followed along with that and made sense with some of what I've been reading. I was going to tell you the site that I've been doing a little bit of looking on that kind of explained it. Sort of like you did. But yeah, it made sense. And I tell you the website, but I can't do it because I'm on the phone and can't do two or three things at once, or it'll sound like I'm brewing coffee over here. But anyway, yes, it did.
Okay. Well, Roger's an old antenna man, too, and he's up next, so I'm sure that maybe he can throw some thoughts in there, too. But that'll get you started and get you pretty close to being where you want to be. W4RFJ, KY6V. Hello there, partner.
Hey, Captain, and good evening to everybody on the second half of the TIN. Sorry, I was a little behind schedule there. I got engrossed in a movie, and next thing you know, I got a text saying, hey, are you going to be here? Well, here I is. So my favorite antenna is a J-pole. A lot of reasons why, and I think that's about it. I just wanted to apologize for being detained elsewhere. Back over to you, Captain W4RFJ.
Hey,
Jay. Okay, I got you, Fred. Stand by one. I'll be right with you, sir. I didn't even realize the boss had sent an inquiry to you. I'm glad it all came together. Did you have any comments that you wanted to compound on what I was telling Mike up there in Maine to in order to sharpen up his antenna? Over.
Actually, no. I thought you explained it quite well. I kind of take it that Mike wants to get out there and, I guess, do it for himself, you know, and that kind of, like, reinforces what you said. I don't think there's anything I could add or take away that would make it any easier, Gordon. You know, it's something that you gotta play with a little bit. Sometimes what I'll do is, rather than cut the wire, I'll just fold it back on itself until I get it real close. That's what I usually do. Over.
Yeah, well, another trick I use too is I normally cut it just a tad longer. Hoping that I'll have to cut and not add on to it, because, you know, that's a pain too. It's a doable function, but hauling out the soldering iron and lowering the antenna and all that kind of stuff. Okay, thank you very much. Put that thing in the text box whenever you find it, Mike, the URL, and I'll take a peek. If not tonight, I'll take a peek in the morning. K2HA, we called you, and you had fallen off the boat, Fred. KY6V, go ahead, sir.
Very good. I'm mobile, that's why. I hope I'm getting to the top of the hill here. I'm just about using the repeater. My question was putting an SWR bridge in the line, does that affect the impedance? Does that degrade the transmission line?
Okay, you are very, very scratchy, but I think I've got the question. No, it does not affect it because the design of the SWR bridge is set for 50 ohms, just like your transceiver is set for 50 ohms, okay? So it won't disturb it at all as a mechanism in the line. Did that answer your question, Fred? Over. He was pretty scratchy, and he said he was on the other side of the hill. We might have lost him. One more time, K2HA, KY6V.
Okay, can you hear me now? This is Fred, K2HA.
Yeah, did I answer your question all right? You're quite broken, but I'm copying some of it. Over.
Yeah, you're fine. Okay, I gotta go because I've just run out of strength on this repeater.
You sure did. You're probably not hearing me. You ran out of string. All right, guys and gals, let's move it on here. Are you ready up there with comments in hand for talking about lightning considerations? It's our next subject. Roger, W4RFJ, KY6V.
Yeah, I think I can pick it up there, and then I guess Section 7 I'll pass back to you, right?
Affirmative, and 6 has got a A1 and A2. Over.
All right. Well, I guess the thing that we're getting into here in lightning considerations is, you know, one of the big things is where to ground. And, you know, I guess one of the biggest issues, and I'm kind of ad-libbing here a little bit, is when you're dealing with HF, you can come up with ground loops if you don't ground properly. But if you have a tower, you're going to want to drive a 10 to 12 foot ground rod into the ground at each point near each tower leg. You know, strap the ground around the tower, around to the tower leg, and additionally run a ground strap to each of the ground rods so that the ground rods are commonly bonded. And a good idea also is to use flat copper strapping and run this from each piece of your shack equipment and then outside to another 10 to 12 foot ground rod. Definitely want to have two separate grounding systems, one for the tower and or antenna, and one for the shack. The question that's listed after this, let me grab a nickel here. I've always heard the ground is not ground the world around. Why is this? Well, the answer to that is ground conductivity has a big part to play in it. In addition, long ground wires can become a problem. They can actually start to radiate. Besides, it is an increasing resistance one must take into consideration the wavelength involved when under an RF environment. When the ground wire becomes a quarter wave with ground considerations, a half wave in length, or even a full wave at length on the RF frequency, this ground wire becomes an antenna. Stop and think about this for one moment. Okay, there's a question or a part here, 6A2, quick disconnects and designs. Trying to unscrew a coax connector when lightning is on top of you can be somewhat of a hair-raising experience. You never know when the next strike is coming, and when you have your fingers on the connector, that could be some bad timing. So be smart and disconnect early when you hear the storm on the horizon. There are some adapter-type disconnects that are available, and you might think about looking at that. One of the things I did when I was in the barracks down here at the shipyard in Philadelphia, I had a mini quad up on the fire escape on top of the building, and actually had lightning hit that. But what my practice was is to disconnect the coax and let it hang out the window. Not exactly the most effective, but it worked. It did take a lightning strike, and it was right next to one of the ground lines that was from one of the lightning rods. So anyway, moving on to question 6A2. I've heard of European G connectors. Can you explain? Let me grab a nickel. Okay, the G connectors that I've seen are designed to be similar to a PL259. The difference is instead of having a screw-on outer shell, it has a bifurcated contacts instead of the screw, in which simply presses over the PL239 socket and makes the contact with the shield side of the connector. Those act more like quick disconnects. Rather than screwing it on, you just push it on. This makes a simple push-pull action or plug-and-play operation in modern-day vernacular. Okay, Gordon, I'm done with Section 6 and lightning protection. The one thing you got to keep in mind, I just want to share that lightning is very unpredictable. So, you know, whatever you think you might be need to be doing may just be the wrong thing to do. You got to really put some heavy-duty thought into how your grounding systems are being put together, especially separate from your home grounding system. That's how people tend to create ground loops. Over to you, Gordon, W4RFJ with the TIN.
Yeah, I have an interesting story, but not for this this time and place about ground loops and what happened to me when I was breaking in the ham radio. But I had a father that was smart enough to get me straightened out pretty quick. All right, thanks, Roger. I guess what I want to know is, was the barracks a second-story type building, and was under anyone down on the first floor when your coax was hanging out? Over.
Well, actually, it was three or four. I think I was on the third floor, and it was a four-story building. And I just let the coax hang down next to one of the gutters that was right next to my window. And, of course, when I operate it, I pull it inside and hook it up to the radio. But it made for a nice little setup. But I did notice one time... Oops, sorry about that. I did notice one time that lightning had hit the coax or the antenna because it was pretty burnt up. So I had to replace it. But anyway, that's my story, and I'm sticking to it.
Yeah, well, I've been doing that for years, too. When I hear it, I just disconnect, throw the coax out the window, or out the door, or whatever the case may be. All right, thanks, Raj. We'll move on to Category 7 here. if I can find out where it is. Here we are. We're going to talk about safety at this point. And we're talking about, you know, using your canoodle when you're climbing a tower, hanging an antenna, shimming up a tree, all of that kind of stuff. I would say the first thing to do is to keep fully aware of power lines and anticipate if the antenna, tower, or any metal, if falling, will miss the lines. We've had some very dramatic and very serious loss of life in the Ham Kingdom through the years of people not being aware of the closeness of the power lines and what it can do to make a devastated situation very devastating. The other thing is, don't work alone. Climb the towers and other objects with the proper climbing safety equipment. I think this all speaks for itself. And always be conscious of not dropping things on the people below. You know, I was in the commercial television broadcasting business for quite a number of years, had an awful lot to do with tower climbing and big tower installations and so on and so forth, and they had a word like a golfer does, you know, when a golfer says four, well, they would say headache, and boy, you better duck, because something was coming down. One of the questions, let me buy a nickel quickly, one of the questions that I normally get asked is, you know, what do you consider the most important safety factor? And my answer is normally just common sense. You know, judge your surroundings, be prepared for the worst, hope for the best. Ounce of prevention is worth a bucket full of cure, and, you know, it goes on and on. I don't know. I see George is connected here. I'm going to see if I can pull him out of the shadows. KW4LCB is an old-time tower guru. He and I have hung upside down on towers together quite a few times, and he knows his stuff. George, are you close enough to your equipment to say hello, and do you have anything else to say other than go up the tower sober and watch out for the people below? KW4LCB, KY6V.
Yeah, buddy. Evening time, Central Florida, and KW4, Lima, Charlie Bravo. You know, Gordon, the first thing I could say, if you're scared to climb it, don't do it. You know, Just go find your tree somewhere and climb that and sit in the limb and kick back and, you know, put your foot out on a limb and grab hold to another one and just kind of, you got to learn to sway, you know, you got to feel comfortable before you even get two steps off the ground there and, you know, I've been doing climbing most of my life, so it was kind of, you know, it's fun to me to put up a tower. Let me drop it one more time. With that said, sir, you know, I'm climbing a one now. Well, not at the moment there, but I've got one outside there that I'm putting up there, and you know, like I've mentioned many a time, one step at a time, you get you a good belt that you could lean back and just feel comfortable in. I have noticed quite a few people, they'll be climbing the tower and they've got a nice belt on,
But yeah, they got one hand holding on that tower, pulling them into the tower. You know, that kind of stuff wears you out there, and not only that, you're not free, you're scared, you know. You got to be able to ease back on that belt and let that belt do the work and have your hands free so you can just reach out there and do what you got to do. Mercy me, I can go on and on about it, you know, and like I said, it's one step at a time till you get up to the apex, and if the rotor comes up with apex, so be it. If not, you know, got to be comfortable leaning down and putting the screws in the bottom of the rotor and right on up there, anything, you know. What can I say? A 20-foot beams, you know, on a cross pipe, you know, it's just as simple as putting up a little old 6-meter beam there. You just take your time and pay attention and enjoy it. Then kick back and if you want to, just drop your drawers and say, kiss it, world, here I come. KW4 Lima, Charlie Bravo.
You got me laughing, George. Yeah, down in Miami when you're doing that kind of thing, they say, you know, moon over Miami. Moon Miami, whatever. Well, very good. I thank you for that. Well, look, before we move on with the program, any questions so far, either on what we're just talking about or have talked about or anything on your mind we'd love to hear from you. This is KY6V. This is the TIN Part 2 for November on antennas, and we're looking for any comments. Call now, please.
RFJ.
RF and 1J. Go ahead, sir.
Yeah, I don't know if people are aware, but, you know, we stress power line safety with the antennas, and I just want to stress that a little bit more. I mean, we're talking about tens of thousands of volts, sometimes hundreds of thousands of volts, depending upon how your neighborhood's wired. And it's usually the topmost wires that are the most deadly. But just wanted to make sure that we stress that. You know, if you're going to be working around antennas or working with antennas, you know, try to put them where they'll be out of that, out of reach of those voltages. You know, I work around a catenary that has 12,000 volts at 25 cycle. Well, some of the wires that are feeding your neighborhoods are up around 30 to 40,000 volts. So just be aware. Back over to you, Gordon, W4RFJ.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure you've run into it too, Raj. But, you know, I've been closer than I wanted to be with friends, hams, and their families that got involved in some of these catastrophes where the family's all up on the roof and they're trying to stick up this 30-foot push-up pole with an antenna on the top of it and get a guy down. The thing gets away from him and bango, it's across the power lines running across the back of the property, and it just fried them all. Just a terrible situation. Okay. How would you like to discuss antennas? And how you have a 200-foot whip antenna on the back of your goat locker. Roger, W4RFJ, KY6V.
Well, I guess with mobile antennas, no matter what band you're operating on, there are a number of things that are common to proper installation. You got to have a good ground to your radio, and your antenna needs to be separately grounded to the car metal frame. You have to obtain your 12-volt power directly from a fuse point at the battery and not a cigarette lighter, and or under the dash fuse block. And there's reasons for that. I mean, I have use special devices that allow me to plug or tap off of a fuse block, but personally, I don't like them. They're limited in current handling capability, and they can always come loose if bounced around. But anyway, you got to remember that an antenna that uses a loading coil to reach resonance at the maximum current being radiated is from the top of the loading coil down. Therefore, placing the antenna as high as practical on the car would be important. In the case of VHF and UHF installations, the maximum bang for the buck is placing the antenna dead center of the roof. This takes the full advantage of using the car as a ground plane. And you got to keep in mind the ground plane is going to affect your radiation pattern too. So make sure the roof is off the metal and not plastic, or all bets are all off. Let me grab a nickel here. One of the questions we have is, why is it important to come straight from the battery? Well, first, it allows you to use larger wire than normally supplied in an automobile. Second, it keeps you away from normal wiring techniques used in the cars, such as crimped wire connectors. And third, it gives you a better chance of not having alternator whine or alternating whine or ignition interference due to the fact of, you know, of all the other wiring blocks and associated circuits that a normal car has in them. Basically, what's happening is the battery is acting as a filter. So I guess I should put it out there to see if anybody has any comments or any questions about mobile antennas. I've been able to play around quite a bit with them, and I'll put out call for check-ins to talk about mobile antennas. W4RFJ with the TIN.
Lima, Charlie Bravo.
Hey, George, what you got for me?
I was just sitting here thinking about your hookup wires, a Roger coming off of your battery instead of your fuse plate there. You know, I've seen them fuse blocks get awful hot there, you know, and wholeheartedly agree with you coming straight off the battery, and especially if you got a little amp going there also there, you know, little 2 meter or 440 amp or how you want to play it, you know, of course, I tell you what, them fumes will kind of get you going in a hurry, and besides that, sometimes you just a little bit can't pull over when you want to. So we thought we'd just kind of add that in there, and just kicking back on high voltage there, and I tried to mention it earlier there, but slipped my mind as far as, you know, lighting and the grounding, you know, like it's mentioned, there's so many ways there. But, you know, lightning could get you no matter what you do. So, you know, I run a ground rod from the tower and also another ground rod for my equipment. Yeah, I must have timed it out or something. I don't know. But, you know, and I have been fortunate. I've had a antenna blow completely apart, found pieces of it in the next yard. Gordon saw that. We'll let you get back at it, my friend. Thank you for doing this. KW4, Charlie Bravo.
Well, thanks for joining us there, George, and certainly do appreciate your feedback. Gordon, I see that you're providing donuts and coffee in the next section. Over.
Yeah, that was the bottom line of the presentation. No, I'm not doing that. Kathy is doing that. Roger, over.
Well, I guess she's going to have to send me some electronically because I'm drooling.
Well, we'll see what we can do to work out. You know, I'd like to add one thing, KY6V here on this mobile installation. And that is, not only do you want to run your ham equipment off of the straight from the battery, you better put a fuse at the battery too, right at the battery lugs. on that line that's coming to your equipment. And I say that because most of the power cords that come, let's say you buy a brand spanking new transceiver, and it's got a DC cable that comes with it. And in a lot of cases, they're smart enough where they fuse both the negative and the positive leads on this cable. But if you look at it, you will find that these fuses in this cable that's supplied are extremely close, within a foot or so of the transceiver itself. And now you got the transceiver in the front seat of the car, right? And the rest of the cable is going out to the battery. You better have a fuse at the battery, because if something happens with that cable, if it starts to fray, moves around in your engine block, you know, so on and so forth, it can develop a short to ground in between your radio and the battery. Not a good thing. It'll ruin your day. Any comments on that, Roger? Over.
Well, I agree with you wholeheartedly. That's part of what I teach in my boating safety course. You know, when you're wiring up your radio in the boat, you should always have a fuse. It's okay to have the fuses up close to the radio, but you should always have one at the battery. Just for that purpose. You know, the wire becomes frayed somewhere in the middle and shorts out, and if you don't have a fuse to cut the circuit off, you're going to have a fire. And there was another thing I wanted to mention, too, and it just escaped me. You know, they've got some systems that you can wire up in your mobile. Depending on, you know, what kind of equipment you're going to run, I use a separate battery for my ham radio equipment, mainly because I don't want it to run down my car battery or my starting battery, and I use a deep cycle and a special circuit that when the truck is running, the battery gets charged. So that's something that you might want to look into if you're worried about emergency communications like I try to set up for. Go ahead, Gordon. Hope I answered your question.
Yeah, you sure did. Thank you, KY6V here. I guess a question for you, Roger. Does your motorhome have dual batteries and, you know, switchable system where you can pick battery A or battery B like a boat type thing? Over.
VH.
Steve is recognized. Actually, I've got several different forms of power capability on the camper. I have the house batteries, which is a dual battery system, which I'm going to be changing out to lithium ion here before too long. And I have a separate battery for the engine, which is the starting battery. And then I have a battery pack that I keep a power supply connected to that gets charged from the 115 or the 120 volts that I feed my radio equipment from. So I've got several sources, and trust me, I try to separate them. Steve, go ahead and pick it up, and we'll talk more about that later, I guess. Steve, pick it up, W4RFJ, then pass it back over to Gordon.
Well, W4RFJ in the group, KF5VH, Steve in Lafayette, Louisiana. I was going to add two comments about mobile operation. When you tie those radios or those amps directly to the battery, if you are forgetful, you may find yourself with a dead battery. And they make devices that you can put right there with the battery, and it monitors the voltage. And if it gets down to a point, and some of the devices you can set where that is, gets down to a voltage, it opens that circuit. So the equipment cannot drain the battery so low you can't start the vehicle. Like that a lot. Let me feed the meter. The other thing is antennas. Don't like putting holes in my cars. I have before. The wife didn't like that at all, so the cars now don't have any type of hole in them. Through the glass antennas work if you're going to be around town. But if you have a window that you can routinely leave closed, they make kits where you use an adhesive and put the antenna mount directly on the glass, side or back glass, actually any glass. You put on a real antenna, and then they use a very fine piece of coax to enter the vehicle, and then you size it up and run it to the radio, unless the radio is close. And as long as I got it, I'll mention dual lock. There's no necessary reason to bolt a radio in place. If you haven't seen 3M dual lock, boy, that is the way to go to put a radio in without a bunch of drill work. KY6V to take it, KF5VH.
Okay, thank you, Steve. I don't think I'm familiar with a dual lock. Can you explain that a little more, or give me a somewhat of a graphic thing? What's it look like? What's it do? Over.
Well, think of Velcro. Now, there's regular Velcro, there's industrial Velcro, and then beyond that is dual lock. So instead of being hooks and carpet, dual lock is identical on both sides. And each pin is sizable, comes up, it looks like a water tower, one of those bulbous water towers. So when you push the two of them together, you have many of those little interlocking spheres holding things together.
Oh, okay. I see what you're saying. Yeah, I've used Velcro on mobile installations. It worked out fine. Yeah, I thought this was some kind of a dual lock where it keep phase from getting your radio out or something, Steve. Over.
No, negative. It, well, let me put it this way. I have, in one of the cars, I have a 2-meter 440 radio mounted, and it is in the very back of the Sienna, and it is mounted vertically. The dual lock is holding the radio in a vertical position, and it doesn't have any support beneath it, and you can drive that car anywhere and run it over anything, and that radio stays right there. Very powerful stuff. I'll try to grab a link for everyone.
Yeah, okay. That would be appreciated. All right. Well, do we have any other comments? I see that we're running 57 minutes into the program, so we're going to be rolling up to the top of the hour here shortly. We are through with the official presentation. If anybody has any questions or comments, we'd sure like to hear them. We've got all the time in the world. I was hoping that we would get some of our members, particularly Roger down in Australia, was hopeful that he might be here tonight. We wanted to talk a little bit about slinky antennas and his firsthand experience and things of that nature. So, at 58 minutes now and counting, do we have any further comments for the good of the order? KY6V, please.
KM4OOC.
Well, hello, partner. Mike, you're looking awfully good on my radio. Tell us all about putting antennas up in the Dakotas when it's 50 below zero. Go ahead, sir.
Well, what I'm trying to figure out how to build is a blizzard-proof vertical antenna, or horizontal for that matter. I'm hoping this is a better winter than what we had last year. We had two blizzards back-to-back. They each lasted 2 days, and they both had winds in excess of 75 miles per hour. Those two storms delivered in excess of 14 feet. 14 feet, can you imagine?
it took a while for that snow to melt. So, it's a little bit of a process trying to get towers and stuff up around here, because you just have to wait and see what the day brings, because the wind blows here all the time. I've got two towers ready to go in the air with the tilt-over mechanisms already mounted on the base plates and all that. And when I get those up in the air and get the guy wires on them, I'll be happy. We're looking at a forecast around the first of the week with a couple of calm days, so if that happens, my son will come down and help me, and I'll complete that project. But it certainly has been that a project. I put up a brand new 2-meter diamond antenna, and the same day, a pigeon thought it would be a good idea to land right on the top of that aluminum antenna and bend it straight over. The same day. Gordon, I just wanted to jump in and say hello. Hope everybody has a great weekend coming up. And it's always fun when I get over here and say hello. KM4OOC.
Yeah, that's interesting. Unless that's a Mobile-type antenna from Diamond. I think most of their bigger stuff is fiberglass. And when lightning hits that fiberglass, it makes a mess. I mean a mess. Seems it wasn't too long ago you and I were talking about putting up a repeater installation. Did you get that accomplished, Mike? Over.
That's what I'm working on right now. That's what one of the towers is for. Hopefully that will be completed next week.
Okay. Good show. Well, keep us posted. What's it going to be? VHF? UHF? Something?
Yeah, it's going to be VHF. I got a couple of choices, really, I can use. The club gave me use of a Yaesu Fusion, but I think I'm going to use this old boat anchor Motorola I got over here that's been modified, because it does 200 watts, and I won't have to have an amplifier or anything, and out here I'm going to need that power, so we're going to make that decision pretty quick, but hopefully that'll all be working at least by Wednesday.
Oh, good show, Mike. KY6V here. Are you going to tie something onto it, like Echolink or IRLP or All-Star or something like that, so we can talk to you? I'm sure that I can't reach you on VHF. Over.
Well, you'll just have to put up a bigger tower with a beam on it to hit my repeater on VHF. Oh, it's definitely going to have Echolink, and I hope to make IRLP available on it as well at a later time. But that'll be one of the first things we do is get Echolink set up on the repeater, because I think at this juncture it's going to be vital, especially here in North Dakota, and for all my friends around Echolink that want to log into it. So yeah, we're going to do Echolink right away.
Fantastic. Way to go. All right. Thanks, Mike. Good luck. Keep us posted when you can, sir. Any other check-ins before we think about starting to close? I see a lot of other gentlemen that I know very well, but they're being very quiet here tonight. Anybody like to say boo before the show is over? KY6V, call now, please.
Lima, Charlie Bravo with a comment for Mike.
NO7O with a follow-up question.
All right, guys, we've got two, LCB and 7 Ocean. George North, stand by one. George South, go ahead with Mike if you'd like. Over.
Thank you, sir. Evening time to you, Mike, there. I heard you mention you set one of them towers for tilt Over. Let me caution you, bud. You get a lot of twist and motion with that, and I'd make sure, you know, get it to the point where she can't do any twisting, especially, you know, the wind conditions you have, because it'll be a headache to you as long as you own it. So think it over close, my friend. KW4, Alima, Charlie Bravo, back to a neck control.
Yeah, well, Mike's been around for a while. I'm sure he knows what he's doing. Any comments on that, Mr. OOC, over?
Yeah, well, I'm well aware of the twisting dangers, and you have to take the right precautions to make sure that doesn't happen. And after 42 years, I figured out a trick or two. So, safety is a big important thing, and if you take all the necessary safety measures, you'll usually prevent most of those structural mishaps as well. But there's a few other things we're doing to make sure everything's nice and solid, and I certainly wouldn't put them up in the air if I wasn't positive it was doing the right way. But I sure appreciate the tip, and I hope other people will take heed to that as well. Thanks, Gordon. KM4OOC.
Okay. Thanks again, Mike. Thank you, George South. Let's hear from George North. NO70, KY6V.
KY6V in the TIN, NO70. Well, since you have a few minutes to spare here, and yep, I understand, Robert, Australia may be inconvenienced. I have about three questions, actually. Number one, do slinky antennas work? Number two, since we know, according to Einstein's theory of relativity, that energy can either be manufactured or destroyed, but that it has to be just transformed in its phase. And number three, because nothing can move faster than the speed of light, according to Einstein's theory. My other question regarding slinking antennas, in addition to whether they work or not, is as they go down the steps with a feed line attached to them, how does that affect the resonant frequency? KY6V, NO70, over to you.
Oh, my goodness gracious and sakes alive, George. KY6V in South Cars. Well, I have never played with a slinky. That was why I was interested to get Robert on board with his experience and ask him some questions. But I would have an awful lot of questions because, as we discussed the other day, George, you know, a slinky is really a flexible inductor. So if you know, how far, what do? You pull it out until your SWR bridge says, hey, you're there, which is going to be shorter than a normal antenna because of its inductance, or do you pull it out to where it has to be pulled out to because that's the only place you can hang it, and then you put an antenna on, a tuner on it, and, you know, tune it up and run with whatever you've got. So, I've got a lot of questions, too, as far as going down the stairs, you know. Factor in the rug. If there's no rug and it's hardwood, what's the reflection coefficient? Is it far enough away not to cancel the signal that you're trying to radiate? And as far as Einstein, smart guy. Go ahead, George, KY6V, over.
KY6V, NO70. I appreciate Victor Hotel's astute observation in the text box. So, thank you, Steve. Well, you know, I did try a slinky antenna one time, and I think it got to the end of the block. Of course, I think height above ground may have been a factor. But, you know, it is made out of metal. And if you're limited for space, hey, if you're putting out RF for a shorter distance, at least it might be worthwhile. I just am intrigued by the versatility that is exhibited by ham radio operators being experimenters and designers that can come up with some workable solutions to difficult problems. And I think one of the most difficult is how to push those RF waves out of the shack and into the ether, right? So what a challenge. We'll have to get Robert in Australia in on this because it sounds like he had something going there. So anyway, thanks for that. All right, thanks for answering my question, and again, good evening to everyone in the TIM. KY6V and W4FJ co-chair, K6SU and our boss, and everybody else on the net, NO70. Go ahead, please.
Okay, thanks, George. KY6V here for South Cars. You know, I'll throw a question right back at you on slinkies. You know, some of the very popular mobile antennas are constructed out of fiberglass with a helical wound portion of the antenna with a stinger on the end of it. Is that type of vertical mobile antenna the same thing as a slinky with a stinger? George, over.
Well, that's a good question, Gordon. I'd have to say it must come pretty close. I actually did use one of those in the some time ago. I think it was called a Hustler mobile vertical. I don't even remember it now, but it was a vertical. The only place to mount it and still be able to park the car in the university facilities because of those height restriction things that they put there. There was nothing in the parking lot to restrict the height. They just wanted to keep big vehicles from going in, so they put this low-slung bar across the driveway. So I could not mount it on the top of the car. I had to mount it on the rear bumper of the car. And since the car is no longer manufactured, I'll go ahead and say it. It was a Fiat Strada, S-T-R-A-D-A. And that should tell you how weird this thing looked with a Fiat Strada, brown in color, going down the road with a black antenna on the back rear bumper made out of the plexiglass with the metal inside. And I better reset. And much to my surprise and my XRL surprise at the time, she's a silent key now, we were both surprised to see that we were actually able to get some 1,200 mile contacts once in a while. And on 80 we got a few several hundred mile contacts, nothing below 50 miles. You know, it was going a long way. But that thing actually worked on that car, and I don't know if the car was made out of metal or something else, but it sure had a lot of strange wiring inside that car. So I think the wiring must have been like a mesh cage or something that helped improve the ground plane. But yeah, so that thing, that antenna actually worked. It was a bear to install and a bear to take down. It didn't dare leave it overnight in the parking lot because it would not be there the next day. But other than that effort, it was an enjoyable antenna to use once in a great while when going on a long trip. So that's my story about a long fiberglass antenna with wear on the inside, Gordon in the net. KY6V, and Chief has a comment here. He says, NO70, back to you, Gordon.
Yeah, okay. I think the Hustlers normally had, as I recall anyway, center-loaded coils. They weren't in the helical fashion like a ham stick. You know, I happen to have a full set of ham sticks for 160 up through 6 meters. And they're good antennas. They work very well if they're mounted properly. Talking about the long bars, you know, you're trying to get things up as high as you can. The legal limit in a lot of areas is 13 feet 6 inches. But the fluorescent lights in your gas station are lower than 13.6, guys. And gals. W4RFJ, go ahead, Roger. KY6V.
Yeah, I was just sitting here thinking about the slinky antenna. Of course, you know, plastic ones don't work. Plastic slinkies don't work as antennas. But the one thing you got to keep in mind, George, and, you know, when you're talking about an antenna system, okay, we're talking coax, we're talking the radiator, we're talking about the whole kit and caboodle. Your impedance of that antenna is dependent upon the inductance, capacitance, and, of course, the velocity factor of the material. So I have seen people use slinky antennas. I've never used them myself because, to me, they're just too hard to deal with. I'd rather just put up a wire, something I can coil up. Slinkies always get messed up on me, but you got to think about that slinky antenna. Yes, it is metal, but it's a coil, and depending on the spacing of the coil, the size of the coil, you know, that's going to determine what length you need for what frequency, and there's formulas to figure that out. That's all I wanted to say, Gordon, and I think George needs to take and send those plastic slinkies back. I don't think they'll work.
No, I think it was Steve that made the comment on the plastic. He's going to have to send them back. Well, I don't know. I was thinking about you the other day when we were getting the program put together that we had this evening. What you need for the goat locker, your motorhome, and for your extendable antenna that you use on HF that won't work on 80 meters is to hang a slinky next to it and load it. Roger, over.
Actually, I'm working on another idea. I actually have a 160-meter coil that goes onto a butternut, and I'm going to do some calculating and figure out what I need on that to increase my or lower my frequency of the antenna. And you know, I got two more of those extendable tubes. These go out to 31 feet, and I'm thinking about lining them up into a dipole fashion, somewhat of a rotatable dipole that extend 62 feet. That might work too, right?
Well, I can see the rotatable dipole. I'm not sure I'm with you on getting the 80 meters. Well, I don't know. Is this inductor, are the coils reachable easy enough? Can you just tap up the coil and find what inductance you need for 80, over?
Oh, yeah. I'll have to mount it, you know, near the antenna, but it would be very easy to do. But anyway, another project down the line. I did get a solution going for keeping the telescoping part of the, you know, the tubing from collapsing in the wind. I've had my Eagle One on the back of the camper for a few months now, and the wind has not even bothered it.
Well, that sounds like it's a very solid Eagle. All right. Well, very good. Thank you very much for being my partner in crime here tonight and last month as well, Roger. Couldn't have done it without you. We're going to make a last call for alcohol here, guys and gals. We're about 20 minutes into the second hour. And my tummy is saying, Gordon, I'm ready for dinner. Last calls. Anybody like to say anything, call now, please. KY6V for South Cars. Okay. I'm not going to let Kathy run the bye-byes here because she told me just a few minutes ago she got disconnected. I think I'm all right, George. I've got one, two, three, four machines recording, and I haven't had any blurps that I know of, so stand by with your recording, and I'll see what I can do in the morning. I think I'm probably going to be okay, so you don't have to bother putting it in the Dropbox or anything like that. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, all those ships out at sea, thank you. This has been the monthly November TIN program. We discussed part two tonight, which was on antennas. Part one was done on the 19th of October. That podcast has been posted to the website. The recording for this evening should be posted sometime tomorrow as well, and then you'll have the family of part one and part two there should you care to re-review or for tell those who weren't here where it's available. So this has been SCARS. The VOIP net schedules and general information may be found on SCARSVOIP.com. SCARSVOIP.com website. Your net controls for this evening have been Roger, W4RFJ, and yours truly, KY6V. We thank you for your participation. We hope that you enjoyed the information that was parlayed here this evening. We're going to return the server back to normal use and abuse and see you all downstream. Thank you and bye-bye from KY6V.